Thank you very much. It's my very personal pleasure to be here. Kathleen and I have did a lot of work together, and it was certainly a high point of things that I did, and that I think for Kathleen also. And so I'm reminded a lot about those years when we worked together. So it's really my great pleasure. And I want to talk about two problems that both of which Kathleen worked on aspects of these kinds of problems. One is on scattering, where we worked together, and the other one is on plasmas, a plasma stability problem. So let me start with the scattering problem. Both of them have to do with asymptotics. So if you have some complicated nonlinear problem, some kind of wave problem, you want to understand the asymptotics as time goes to infinity. So in some cases you can describe it by a much simpler equation, which describes the asymptotic behavior. I'm talking about a problem which does not have dissipation, so it doesn't just go to some steady states. And I just want to. Yeah, that's what I wanted here. It's skipping. Here we go. That's what I wanted. So there's a little sketch. So the idea is you have some complicated thing happening in some interaction region, and as time goes from this, say, particle path is going from a free state to another free state. This is time plus minus infinity plus infinity. So I'm talking about a problem which is where you have more or less some conservation of energy. And so you can go either way to plus infinity or minus infinity in time. Oops, it's supposed to work. Okay, so the problems that I'm going to be talking about are problems where you have some energy, natural energy norm, and you have given a solution of the complicated problem, you look for a solution of the simpler problem, which in this case is linear, which is asymptotic to it in this natural norm. As t goes, so you got two states, the plus and the minus, and as t goes to plus or minus infinity, it converges to that. So these simpler ones we call free solutions. And what I will call for today the global scattering problem is to prove in proper cases that every solution of the complicated equation, the nonlinear complicated equation, is a scattering state in the sense that every solution there exists of such a pair. If that's true for every solution, I'll call that the global scattering problem. And there were only two cases where that was known. Basically two cases, interesting cases, let's say, where you have, so one of them was nonlinear Klein-Gordon, or you could also get rid of that third mass term, that's a variation. So nonlinear Klein-Gordon, which is the first equation in red there, or the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Now, I'm going to just be talking always about the nonlinear term being of this type, which is gauge invariant nonlinear term. That means the argument. It has the U here, the argument of U here, like that. And P is bigger than 1. And so by making this choice, this is called sometimes nowadays the defocusing case. The norm you pick for these two cases. Here you pick the H1 norm, and in the first equation you pick the usual energy norm, which you can write as a product like this with initial position and velocity. Okay, so first I'm going to just state very quickly the well-posedness, because you have to know that you can solve the equations. So so the initial data is just in that energy space and not more special. Arbitrary things in the energy space. So if the power, which is assumed bigger than 1, P, of the nonlinearity is less than or equal to this number, which is a Sobolev number of some kind, less than or equal to it, then it's known that this is, that it's well posed. And I should say that the equal sign there is much harder than the strictly less sign there. And there are people in the audience who worked on this, who solved that problem. But I'll just leave it at that. What I want to emphasize now is the scattering problem today. And global scattering is true for both those equations, as long as you have this condition, and you also have, this is another critical number, also related to Sobolev inequality. so if P is bigger than this number, and less than equal to that, then in fact you have the global scattering, means that you have these asymptotic states like I talked about before, and then you have a mapping, and the mapping is really a nice mapping, it's a diffeomorphism from energy space onto energy space, one-to-one onto, and even analytic in some cases as a map. Okay. So that was the known, and I should say, just talking a little bit about history here, that it took a long time to do this, to prove those theorems, especially, well, both theorems, but I'm talking mainly about the scattering one, and it was Irving Siegel who conjectured this rather boldly, and then there was this paper that Kathleen and I wrote in 1972. I guess I can use this thing. Yeah, this paper, where we were able to prove this for the nonlinear Klein-Gordon case. Not quite as in as much generality as that. It took a while. Anyway, and then other people worked on this problem. That was not quite as general as the case that, as the theorem I stated. Let's see, let me go on. So there are two weaker things here. So what we actually did was something like this, Kathleen and I. We took initial data that were quite nice and asked just whether those are scattering, whether the solution you get from such initial data is a scattering state. That's what we did then. It was only later that we realized that it was realized by various people that you could go to all finite energy states. And a somewhat easier problem besides that, another easier problem is to look, if you start with a free solution like U minus, if you start with a free solution, you ask whether there's a nonlinear guy which is asymptotic to it. That's a much easier problem. That's called existence of the wave operator. That is not necessarily so easy, but usually much easier than. Okay, so now the question is that I want to raise today is this true for any other type of equation? And so that's been kind of an interesting question. Whoops, I didn't want to do that. Whoops. All right, how'd that happen? Okay, let me go back. I guess I have to be careful with this hardware. Okay, so we're up to here. Okay, there we go. All right, so the answer is yes. So the same kind of theorem, just the same kind of thing. This is very recent. This is 2008. Okay, so if you, the amazing thing is that it's very, these methods that are used are very specific to the equation. In some ways. And the only difference between this equation and the nonlinear Klein-Gordon equation is that you have a different elliptic operator here, about the simplest fourth order operator you can think of. it should be a plus. It's a mistake. Okay, that's a mistake right there, is a plus. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, right. Okay. So with this equation, with the plus sign there, and again, defocusing, otherwise everything else is the same. This is the same kind of term we had before with the power P. And so now, so first the well-posedness, which was proved by Steve Lewandowski 10 years ago, that P, so this Sobolev number that appears here is related to the order of the elliptic operator. So the natural thing is this number, and as long as P is less than that number, we're well-posed. P equals that is not yet solved, but I'll bet it's true. Yeah?
Is there a typo between A and B? Because P seems to be on the back side.
Whoops. You mean here?
Yes.
No, this is the upper bound. This is the lower bound. No, this is right. This is right. This is instead of 1 plus 4 over N, which was the case that you're familiar with.
Aren't A asserts that it's well posed if P is sufficiently small? Is it well posed if P is really big as well?
Oh, if in addition. So in addition to that assumption, I'm also assuming that. Yeah, is that answer? Yeah, okay, fine. Sorry. If in addition, yeah, so I have both inequalities. So in part B, I have both inequalities. So this is it's analogous to the other case. The exact analog, except I don't have the equal sign here, at least not yet. And the other thing is the dimension is at least 5. Well, so in fact, I should say that, okay, so this theorem B, which is a major theorem, is due to Benoit Poisardere just recently. And it's for dimension at least 5 because that 5 is related to the order of this guy. But he also has just proven the same thing for all the dimensions, the low dimensions, if the initial conditions are spherically symmetric, radial, and it's still, well, we're actually talking about trying to get the non-radial case for the low dimensions. But the method is somewhat different. Anyway, I'm just stating this because this is the only thing that's published so far. So I just want to say, okay, a few more things. Okay, so the general program of the method is about the same for all these different problems. We have three main different problems we're talking about, the two that I started with and this recent beam equation. Okay, so there are two main ingredients. One is an estimate for the nonlinear problem, an a priori estimate. The other one is an a priori estimate for the linear problem. So for the nonlinear problem, these are usually called, the starting point is usually called Morawetz estimates. This is very appropriate today. I call them Morawetz type estimates because now there are so many Morawetz estimates. And probably, Kathleen, you won't even recognize some of them anymore. You know, that's what happens after a while. But anyway, there are various generalizations in different cases. But there's a series of them that Kathleen did in the 1960s in the basic cases. And then since then, some of them, particularly one of them in particular, has been used a tremendous amount in recent years. That's the one I'll mention in a moment. So, and then there are the estimates for the linear equation, and the main ones that are really, really important, have turned out to be really important, are called Stricart's estimates, or Stricart's type estimates, which he also probably won't recognize anymore because they get more and more sophisticated. Just tell you something about the nonlinear, the Morawetz estimate. So this particular estimate was proven by Kathleen in a short paper in the Irish Academy of Sciences, right? Wasn't that it?
It was in the Royal Society.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That one. This estimate. was proven for, well, first for a Klein-Gordon case, and then for a Schrodinger case, and then it was proven by Steve Lewandowski and me more recently, you know, a few years ago, for this Beam case, this third case. So, in fact, when we proved this, we said, oh, now we can do the whole Beam problem, but it turned out to be still very difficult. Anyway, but that's one of the ingredients. So you prove this, it's part of a long energy identity. And particularly for the Beam case, it takes a lot of pages of long calculations, which is why it took so long for anyone to find it. So what, if you just look at the, why is this a useful estimate? Well, it's only slightly useful. If you look at this and look inside a cone, so take a cone in space-time, with R is just a constant. Take such a cone, and you know, for a hyperbolic problem, everything is cones, so that's natural. So just take the cone, and just take this on the cone in particular here. Then you can replace, for the cone, this, you can replace X then by RT. So you replace X by RT, and then you get this estimate. I put the R on the other side. E is energy. And so you have this estimate, and you see this part here I've written in red here, dt over t. That's just barely not integrable. That's what you want. You want it to be not integrable. If this were integrable, then it wouldn't say anything because the interior integral here is part of the energy, which is already bounded, it's defocusing case, and so it would say nothing. But the fact that this is not integrable means that the guy inside here must be small for certain large intervals of time. So this was the original idea, that actually using this in this way and then working with it was in the work Kathleen and I did together years ago.
In the case of a Beam, you still work with cones?
Yeah, I'll get to, well, if I have time, I'll get to that. Yes. Yeah, you work, so you take a cone, you take R big, and the same with Schrodinger equation. Same with Schrodinger equation, it's sort of the same deal. You don't have this, but that's a really good question because, yeah, you work with a cone. So inside a cone, you get the estimates you want, and then outside the cone, you have to do another estimate. That's what you have to, there's a missing part there. Well, let's see. I'll try to get to that. And then you have decay estimates, of which the basic one, so if M is the order of the elliptic part of the equation in all three cases. Then you have that decay rate where C depends on the initial conditions in some way. That's the simplest estimate. And then you have estimates. Okay, then you have, for example, this S for Schrodinger equation, which is, take the Schrodinger equation, which is simpler to work with. This estimate is an LP type estimate, which just comes from interpolating between L1 and an L infinity. You get an LP, L1 and an L. The L1 L infinity estimate, interpolate that with the L2 conservation. And you just get this. This is elementary. But then for Klein-Gordon or Beam, you have something a little more complicated here, which I've written down with two different powers because you have the Sobolev, because you have the Sobolev norm H1, so you have some embedding there, so you get power. One of them is for small time, one of them for large time. And okay, so maybe I'll just explain, why do you get these two rates? Why do you get two different rates here? Well, because for, yeah, because for the Beam case, let's take the Beam case here. So here's a linear operator. That's just a linear. I have the correct plus sign here this time. That's the linear part of the equation. And you can factor it into two guys. So you have each one of them is like this with a plus or minus. Let's just take the plus. And the thing is that if you look at this for high or low frequencies, meaning this think of this as, take the Fourier transform. So this is like C to the fourth power here. That's C to the fourth power over here. Then just expand in high and low frequencies, then you'll see for high frequency it looks like that, and for low frequency it looks like that. So that's why you get the two different rates. And so now you have the strict, then you have also the Strickarth estimates, which are space-time estimates, which are now known to follow from the previous ones I mentioned. So that's for Schrodinger equations. This is a well-known one. This is very well-known now. And then Lewandowski, 10 years ago in his thesis, he proved that for this beam equation, this is a linear beam equation, the one with the linear equation I just mentioned, you have a similar estimate. I'm writing it in a way which, I'm trying to write it in a way which is analogous here. So here, because you have the H, this is now the H2, this is the energy. This is the energy norm for the beam problem. Okay. So for a certain range of P's, okay, it comes out to be that. And then they're increasingly sophisticated estimates. So one of them, Posadaire, needed this estimate, which is a mixed LPLQ. This is not mixed. This is a P plus 1 in space and time. This is a mixed LR in time, LQ in space, under certain conditions, which you don't have to be read them so carefully. Okay, well, I think what I'm going to do, since I want to go into the other problem, I'm going to skip the proof, and maybe, Louis, I can tell you a little bit about how Posadaire managed to do the, and the other, yeah, here's the cone picture, which I'm skipping. I'm going to go to the other problem. There, that problem. Okay, so this is a problem. Kathleen wrote, well, I guess when you were funded by the Atomic Energy Commission, she wrote at least one paper, I don't know exactly what, about it was called MHD shock structure without collisions, but the starting point was what we would now call the Vlasov-Maxwell system. And Kathleen was looking for steady-state solutions with a shock structure. And so a long time later, Yan Guo and I, where's Yan? There, yeah. And I started working on the question of given equilibria, which we know there are lots and lots of them, whether they're stable or not. And I'm not going to give you a lot of history here, but I want to just tell you about the work that Jiwoo Lin and I have been doing recently. Okay, so I first have to state what the problem is. So we're going to do it in the relativistic format. So this would be this is x dot equal velocity. Velocity is in my notation is v hat, and v is momentum. In physics, you would call it p probably. The force acting, if you take a particle acting with a force, you'd put the force here, x double dot equal the force. But here the force is the electromagnetic force. So you got particles which are interacting just through their charges. And here's an electromagnetic field. Okay, standard thing. My notation is that, again, is V is momentum. And V bracket is the Japanese bracket, which is the energy. And I've normalized all constants to be one, so I'm not doing an approximation where, you know, the electron has much less mass than the ion, because that's not. We could do that, but it's not relevant to what I want to say here. So I'm just simplifying to get all the constants equal to one, and then this is the velocity vector, and then when you look at the collective behavior, you're looking at the particle density. Each particle is going like that. And so you're looking at a density in phase space, which is F. Now, the plus and the minus here is the charge. So plus is ions, minus is electrons. and you have the electromagnetic field. And then you have just, you have the Vlasov equation, this guy, also called the collisionless Boltzmann equation, this guy right here. And all this is all this says is that the characteristics of this hyperbolic problem are exactly those particle paths which are at the top. Okay, so that's the equation. That's the basic equation, but E and B are the electromagnetic field is unknown, so here it is written very classically. These are just exactly Maxwell's equations, exactly, where you have the charge, is that you just add up the charges of the individual particles with the plus ions, electrons, and the current is given by this. So it's just Maxwell. So it's just Maxwell's equations, which are linear, and Vlasov equation, which is nonlinear only in this term. Okay, so that's same place where Kathleen started in that paper from the 1960s. And the energy is constant. This is the energy, and because this is electromagnetic, this is kinetic energy, but it's relativistic, so that's the energy right there. Instead of being V squared, looks like that, where V is the momentum. And the well-posedness in general in the three-dimensional case is still an unsolved problem. It's a big unsolved problem. But with some certain symmetry assumptions, it's been solved by Glassy and Schaefer in a series of papers, in particular cylindrical symmetry, which I'm going to talk about. And I want to introduce potentials like this, standard physics potentials. Vector potential and a scalar potential, which in this way, and then the Maxwell part of the equation is just reduced to these two equations. Okay. There are various examples. I think I'm going to not really go through this very much, but the simplest example is homogeneous, where you don't have any spatial dependence for. So you take an equilibrium solution, and then if you have no spatial dependence, that's one kind. You have the Penrose, this Oliver Penrose criterion, and various other things. Okay, then you have problems where equilibria, meaning independent of time, that depend on X, on space. So you got various things. I'm going to skip this though. So let me go on because I only have so much time to the problem I really want to talk about now. So I want to take three dimensions, and I'm going to take cylindrical coordinates. So the problem I'm going to talk about has symmetry in it, has cylindrical symmetry. And the reason we don't know how to do it without some serious symmetry like that. We don't know how to do the problem. I don't know what the answer even is, but this is three dimensions, and the only symmetry we're assuming is cylindrical. So this is what we're going to be assuming. We take the three-dimensional case, but theta, so you have, you know, in cylindrical coordinates, cylindrical are r, theta, z, usual cylindrical coordinates. So if we're assuming everything's independent of theta, all theta derivatives are gone, but some of the components, see, this is the basis in the three coordinate, the usual cylindrical orthogonal basis, but some components may be in the theta direction. Okay, so you have to be consistent about that. Anyway, so for example, the vector A will have a theta component, A theta. Actually, that should not be bold-faced. That's the component. Should not be bold-faced. And the equilibrium, when I write the equilibrium, I'm going to look at the equilibrium, and I will look at whether it's stable or not. So I take an equilibrium, which I won't specify too much, but the superscript zero always means the equilibrium. That's why I put those zeros there. Okay, so here you... Okay, so it takes... So So, okay, an equilibrium would have such a form. And now we're going to take a more specific form of equilibrium. First of all, you have, when you look at the ODE that I wrote in the first place, you have two invariants. You have the energy and you have, and now I'm in cylindrical coordinates. So I'm going to take the angular momentum, but I take a component of it. Okay, so this would be the angular momentum, and I take the z component, so x, y, z. These are the vertical, So x here, x here is the vector x. Z is a component of the x. Sorry. So these guys are invariants. Okay. All right, there. Okay, so now they're invariants. In other words, the particle, those two quantities are constant on that Hamiltonian flow, which is the particle path. And now I'm going to assume this form for the equilibrium. If you assume that the equilibrium is a function of those two invariants, then automatically the Vlasov equation is satisfied. The Vlasov equation is just the collective equation for that ODE, for the particle path. Okay, so that satisfies it. But then you still have to satisfy Maxwell's equations. And Maxwell's equations then reduce to these two guys. Here's the scalar potential, and here's the theta component of the vector potential. And they have to still satisfy this elliptic system. But there are many, many solutions of this guy, which I won't go into detail about that. I want to talk about, given these many, many different solutions, which ones are stable. Okay, so the equilibria, therefore, are equilibria of this form at the top are solutions of some elliptic system which has lots and lots of solutions. Okay, so here's, now I want to state the theorem. I take the particle density, remember on the previous slide, mu was the function of two variables, EP, and mu is a scalar, and mu is the density of particles of the equilibrium, so it has to be positive. So I assume it's positive. And when I write mu is a function of E and P, those two invariants, and I assume that it's decreasing in the energy, E, strictly. So also assume that the equilibrium has compact support in the space in XV, in space momentum, in space. And I also consider, I'm only considering axisymmetric, meaning cylindrically symmetric perturbations. So that's the world in which we're dealing. And then, of course, if you ask for stability, you linearize the whole problem, and it has to do with whether some linearized problem has a positive, or some operator is positive. But what I'm saying is there's some operator which is much, much simpler than that, because I have a complicated system. So this, it's not so simple, but it's a lot simpler than what we started with. This L0, I'm going to describe L0 in a moment. There's a certain operator L0, which I'll describe in a moment, which its positivity is equivalent to stability. Now, what I mean by stability, I take the weakest form. I just ask, is there a solution which is exponentially growing of the linearized problem? I take the linearized problem, I look for a solution like that, and I ask whether there's a solution with real part lambda greater than zero or not. If there is, that's a growing mode, Stability in the weakest possible form would mean there's no growing mode. Okay, so that's a rather weak way to say stability. I think I skipped something. Somehow I'm skipping. Okay, so Now I'm going to describe the operator. Now I said L0 is much simpler than the original, than when you linearize, but it isn't so simple. Okay, what's really simple about it? The point is, it's an operator acting only on scalar functions. It only operates on scalar functions of x. So h is a function of x. H is a function of x, which is the 3-vector x. And that, it is a lot, you have to take my word that it's a lot simpler. This thing that I'm describing is a lot simpler than the linearized operator to start with. At the end, I'll give you an example. We can verify everything. So what it is, the thing to keep in mind, is that it's a Schrodinger operator. It's like a Schrodinger operator, and then it has some non-local terms to it. So it has this form. This is what the operator is. But look at this term right here. This term is this term, is this guy. So that operator acting on a function, h is only a function of x. Here's your Schrodinger. Here's your Laplacian. Here's a potential. Here's another potential. This is only a function of x after you integrate. That's d mu dp. And here is a non-local term, which I'll describe this script p, I'll describe to you in a moment. And then you have, that's this part. And then you have another part, which is also non-local here, this has a similar character to that. And b0 doesn't have the Laplacian in it. And okay, so it's something. What's this script p? The script p comes from the Vlasov equation. You take the Vlasov equation and you linearize it. So I linearize it around a steady state, and there may be an external field also. So this is just the linearized operator, and you look at its kernel. And now you project onto the kernel. This is L2 with a weight function. This is d mu d e. And this is an operator that averages particle paths over phase space, if you analyze it some more. Now, the kernel of this operator includes all functions which are just functions of E and P, those two invariants, and a little bit more, but basically it's functions of E and P. Anyway, that's the operator. It doesn't look very simple. It isn't so simple, but it's simpler, much simpler. Okay. And so to prove, maybe I will not say much about the proof. The proof of the linear stability, we use the global invariance, the invariance of the linearized problem, and some variational argument. And the instability proof took us a long time to solve. And the potential of the potential. A, R, A, Z are two of the components of the vector potential, and we go back and take and express those as derivatives. This uses cylindrical symmetry. And we use several arguments that Zhi Wu Lin discovered in other contexts. So now I want to tell you that I stated a couple of theorems about linear stability and instability. These are if and only if theorems. But my definition of stability was a very weak one. It just says there's no growing mode. But in fact, in some cases, we can actually show that it's really stable or really unstable when you look at the full nonlinear problem. So now I'm going back to the nonlinear problem, but we have no idea how to do it in the complete cylindrically symmetric 3D case. That's, so far, that looks a little beyond our capabilities. So we go to another case, this case, which is simpler, which has a lot of symmetry in it, so-called 1.5 dimensional, where you just have one x variable, which I call x, and y and z don't appear, and the velocity, the momentum, it doesn't have a V3, and the electric field doesn't have that, and the magnetic field is pointing in the Z direction. The classical case with the moment, the magnetic field points up. Okay, take that case, and we're going to, and in this problem, we take period P. The other problem was in all three space, unbounded space, but here we take period P, which obviously makes it it compactifies things. Okay. And I'm not going to state the linear theorem, which is the exact analog of the previous one. I will take, okay, and I will, for simplicity for this talk, I will take this equilibrium, an equilibrium which is a function of E and P, well, you can have ions and electrons, and it just has this form. E is just the simple energy of a free particle, and you have this angular momentum, which turns out to be this. So psi naught is like the capital A we had before, which is the magnetic potential. B is just one just third component, Z component. It just has a magnetic potential. And these are the same assumptions we had before. And I'm going to assume it's even, for simplicity, it's even in P, and mu dk is a function of V. Okay. And so here's a theorem. Here's an instability theorem. So these are going to be if and only if. So to some extent. Anyway, so the important assumption is that I assume that operator, that complicated operator I showed you before, has some negative spectrum. Okay. So it's self-adjoint. By the way, that's a self-adjoint operator. It has some negative spectrum. So assuming it has some negative spectrum, then, which is exactly part of that previous theorem, then, in fact, you see that even when the initial data is very close, delta for any, even though when the initial data is very, very close within delta of the equilibrium has this little zero on top. And this equilibrium is zero. That equilibrium, that's the equilibrium there and there. The nonlinear solution of the nonlinear problem, forget the TS for a moment. You see that for within a certain time of size log delta, the magnetic field here stays relatively far away from the equilibrium. And the electric field also stays relatively far away from its equilibrium, which is zero, within an exponential time, within time log delta, which means you're talking about exponential time. And the norms are also interesting. This is just the L1 norm. That's good. Okay. And TS is translation. So this is a kind of orbital instability. Okay, I'm going to end here. So I want to state also a stability theorem. Stability theorem, well, I'm going to state an even more special case. So I'm going to be assuming it has this form where that's the real E. That's 2.7, et cetera. That's that E. and this is some function gamma of the moment. So it's more special than the previous case. Makes it a lot easier to analyze. And here we really have stability. So if you take initial data that's very within delta of the equilibrium, then you see, whoops, that's a mistake, the opposite. Oh, wait, I copied it from the previous, this is tech. Sorry, oh, that's a terrible mistake. I want the less than epsilon, that epsilon. It should be less than this epsilon. Sorry, that's less than epsilon, okay? All right, there you see, this is less than epsilon. So it's exactly, in fact, it's pretty good norms too, including it's good norms. It's the same kind of thing. It's exactly what you want. It's really nonlinear stability. And it's exactly, and this is exactly under the condition that the operator up there has only non-negative spectrum. So at least in some cases that you can really verify this thing. And none of these theorems are easy to prove, I must say. So I'll finally end up with an example where we can show everything, and this is just an artificial example. You take your equilibrium to have this form. So this is the P, the momentum, and this is the energy in here. And so it's a special case of that. And I take this inhomogeneity to be epsilon cosine x. It's nice and simple. And the period is going to be 2 pi, naturally. That's the period. And I take this epsilon to be small. And then we can prove using these two previous theorems that in this example, this equilibrium is stable in this sense under perturbations of period 2 pi, but it's unstable under perturbations of period 4 pi. So that's the same equilibrium. It depends on which period you pick. So there's a lot here and a lot of unsolved problems. I think probably much more can be done with this in the future. But anyway, thank you very much for listening to me.